Assalamu alaikum and hello to everyone listening. My name is Muhi Khwaja with the American Muslim Community Foundation Muslim Philanthropy Podcast. Today on the show we have Maggie Osborne, who is the Senior Vice President and Chief Strategy Officer at the United Philanthropy Forum. Welcome to the show, Maggie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yeah. So, you know, on the show, we love having different nonprofit organization leaders and people in mainstream philanthropy talking about the importance of charitable giving and just kind of best practices and trends and everything like that. So we're really honored to have United Philanthropy Forum on the show and also glad to be a member of the organization through the National Committee for Responsive Philanthropy.
Great. One of our very great and active members.
Definitely.
So glad you're connected.
Yeah. And, you know, this work that we do of charitable giving really, hopefully in my mind, is what sets the tone to create like a more positive world in the world that we want to live in. And part of that for me is just kind of throughout my life, finding those moments that really define my purpose and mission and working towards that. And I'm really glad and honored to be doing something every day that I feel is achieving that. So similarly, like, you know, I want to hear more about like your life journey to kind of, you know, where you went to school, where you grew up, your family, those things that identify you and why you wanted to join United Philanthropy Forum. So if you can take us through that journey, I would appreciate it.
Sure. It's not a straight journey. It's a very crazy, crooked journey. But I was born and raised in Baltimore, and I just moved back here after being gone for 30 years because I am one of eight children.
Wow.
And all of them live in Maryland. And my parents, thank God, who are still with us at 88 and are in good health, are both living on the Eastern Shore. So I'm at a point in my life when it was time to come home. But I, you know, I started here, and that growing up in an Irish Catholic family where responsibility to other, being a person for others, was sort of fundamental in how I grew up. As a family, we were always doing charitable giving, charitable events. You know, at Christmas time, we always would adopt a family from a parish in the city. And the priests were always really grateful because my mother always wanted the biggest family, because every one of us would get our own child that we would write a Christmas letter to and really think about what we were doing for them. So it was sort of in my blood, but then I kind of kicked away. I have an art background and had a real passion for fashion. So I went to college. I started at University of Maryland, but moved quickly to Notre Dame of Maryland University, which was my mother's alma mater and my sister's alma mater. But while I was there, I also worked full time in the fashion industry. I was a consultant, an interiors consultant for Laura Ashley. And then I also worked as a student intern for the art department. And I was the only art history major at my college. So I needed to go other places to get the things I needed. So I did some work at Johns Hopkins University here in Baltimore. And then I also did some things trying to build a study abroad program, because I thought it was crazy that you could have an art program and not have people go see the art. And so I ended up through Towson State University in Maryland going to Italy for a semester abroad. And I was just so captured by the country and by the people and the culture. And so I came back and I finished my degree and my thesis, and I moved to Italy without much of a plan. You know, I was doing sort of student stuff. I decided I would take Italian classes in the morning, and then I got a job selling sort of faux Gucci pocketbooks in the market, and I taught English in hotels, and I did all kinds of crazy stuff. But then I ended up staying in Italy. I came back and forth some, but then I went to work when I was home for Saks Fifth Avenue and started that career in high-end retail and women's designer sportswear. And then I went back to Italy and had a job with Salvatore Ferragamo,
Very nice.
Which is one of the oldest houses. Yeah, it was sort of my dream existence. And then I came home and went back to work for Saks and did some other things. And I was really on that kind of a journey of really just high-end retail. But it was at a time, again, in the country when everybody was being bought out by everybody else. And it was kind of strange. The person that used to make the coffee in the buying office became the buyer. I mean, it was kind of like a crazy time. And, you know, I, at that time, had a really serious car accident one day coming home from work. And so I had sort of 6 weeks to lay on my back. And that day that I had the accident, I'd sold a pair of $7,000 Golemay hot pants to an old woman. And I thought, this is insane. What am I doing with my life? And so I decided to start taking some courses in nonprofit management. And, you know, I'd been a great, really involved in a lot of great volunteer projects. There was a literacy, the literacy bank, the learning bank in Baltimore. And I also helped to do some work raising money for a neonatal care unit at a hospital here. And it just was more my core.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided to get married. And the person I was marrying, this architect, was moving to Florida, had moved to Florida. And so that was actually an interesting moment to sort of walk away from high-end fashion because there wasn't a whole lot happening in Tampa, Florida, 30 years ago in that realm. And I got hired the 2 days after I got married in Baltimore. I had a meeting with someone that I had been on the phone with who was an attorney for a big law firm, Holland & Knight, that was going to chair the United Way campaign. And they didn't want to give a lawyer up as a loaned executive. Yeah. So he wanted to hire me to be the loaned executive and his troubleshooter for the campaign. Mm-hmm. So 2 days after my wedding, I went to interview with him in person. And what I was interviewed by was the entire law firm over cocktails, which is a really interesting experience.
Wow.
To have 40 attorneys asking me questions. And I reported to work the next day. And that was my transition into the not-for-profit sector as a career. And I worked for United Way. I was a division director. And then I went to work for one of the agencies that served pregnant women in crisis when I happened to be pregnant with my first child. So it was a very interesting experience in many levels. I did many different things. My mother would say that my resume looks like the poo-poo platter of life, which is now actually in vogue. Because I wanted to get more experience and I wanted to learn more. So I worked for the Florida Aquarium. I was vice president of a community foundation. I worked for a long time for a private foundation as their grant manager. I had my own consulting company simultaneously for 18 years that focused really on boards and funders and their understanding of their grantees and vice versa. I kind of created this niche about being a facilitator, a translator. And so that was wonderful. I did one of the most unusual projects that gave me a whole nother perspective on a world I was not familiar with. This a friend of mine, it was a harbor pilot. And he came to me and said, I want you to do this project with me. There is a World War II ship that is the last of its kind that is salvageable. And I want to write to Congress and get them to give it to us. And I want to bring it to Tampa and restore it and make a memorial for merchant mariners who had been in service through World War II and beyond, where this ship started. It's called the American Victory Ship. And they were always in danger. They were bringing supplies and they were also bringing back the war dead. To be buried in this country. And so they had this incredible role and they're not particularly recognized. So I spent days on this huge 400-foot ship with a bunch of 70-year-old volunteers who were tough as nails and taught me an awful lot about who they were and different parts of that history that I just didn't know. So I've done all kinds of things. I then helped the foundation I was working with, helped found what became the Florida Philanthropic Network, which is the philanthropy serving organization for the state of Florida. And so I was a member of that organization. Then I was hired to do some leadership training. And then I became their vice president. And that is sort of how I came into the PSO world. And then nice. I left Florida to become the CEO for the Connecticut Council of Philanthropy, which is the Connecticut state organization. We all were talking, and there was this buzz and this moment of inspiration about what the Forum Network could become, because in the first 18 years of its life, it was really 33 regional associations of grant makers, like Florida Philanthropic Network or the Connecticut Council. They were all regionally based, so they represented, you know, either state or a portion of a state or multiple state area, and were becoming a stronger network. And so we began in 2015, when there was a leadership change, taking a step back and saying, what role does this organization play in the ecosystem of philanthropy? You know, what can we do to make philanthropy better? And at the same time, there were a bunch of national organizations that were serving philanthropy that were not particularly connected to one another or tethered to any central group. And they said, what would it look like if you opened up that network to include us? And we talked with many funders who said, you know, this ecosystem is sort of disorganized and it's very hard to work with. Is there a way to organize it? And so a vision design group was formed and worked for 7 months to come up with a way to do this. And in January of 2017, United Philanthropy Forum opened up so that it wasn't just the regional folks with those great on-the-ground relationships. It was also open to all the national organizations that were either identity-based, like mm-hmm. Hispanics in Philanthropy, or mission, you know, issue-based, like Grantmakers Concerned with Immigrants and Refugees, or sector-based, like Center for Effective Philanthropy, or the NCRP, which you had managed and that you're mentioned and you're a member of. Or it was folks like the National Network for Family Philanthropy, right? National mm-hmm. Senate Council for Family Philanthropy. And so now this organization, this network that is the forum, is up to 89 organizations that represent well over 7,000 foundations across the country.
Wow.
So it's the largest network representing philanthropy in America. And it's been an extraordinary 4.5 years of doing this and watching this infrastructure grow. And I think it's always interesting because most people don't think about, is there any infrastructure? What is the infrastructure behind all the foundations? And so the United Philanthropy Forum is a really vital part of that infrastructure to make philanthropy better.
Yeah. And you come with such a unique experience of, you know, having served nonprofits, having served foundations, having served yeah. families and the grantees. So you bring a really great holistic perspective to this position, and I think are such a great value add to the forum.
Thank you. That's a great way to say that. I'll have to say that to my mother.
Well, moms always have a unique way of complimenting their children, right?
Yes.
So in terms of, you know, you've now established this national network and are leading this with a team of, you know, other C-suite members on your team and managing all of these relationships, what are some of these direct programs and services that you're providing these philanthropic networks?
So we really have four pillars, core pillars of work. The first is, it's kind of an interesting one. It is the knowledge management collaborative. Early on, probably, I'm not even sure how many years it is. I know that the person who runs it has been with the forum from the beginning, really for 16 years. So I think it's over 10 years that the original regional associations all needed to have platforms for their their member management and for their websites. And so this collaborative was formed because they believe that everybody should, you know, have the advantage of having sort of the same level of great stuff. And if they came together, they could do it in a way that was affordable and accessible to everybody. And so this collaborative was formed and continues to grow. I think at this point, we're at 35 of the organizations who are linked into this. And it's a unique model because there are members of the collaborative that work together to become expert and offer help to one another. So they've built skills. Some of them have become, I forget what the terminology is, but expert in Salesforce. There's a term for it. So that is an
like a subject matter expert.
Yeah, there's an actual technical term for it, but people have built their skill set. So now in these organizations, we have these kind of super users who give back to the collaborative in terms of their knowledge. So that's one pillar, is the knowledge management. Another pillar is our racial equity, diversity, inclusion work, which is more inside than outside. So we are trying to build the skills of our members, the philanthropy serving organizations, to do this work internally, as well as be responsive to their members who are trying to move some of this work forward. So that is really supported by Borealis Philanthropy and some others that have enabled us to do that, understanding that if we as practitioners in serving philanthropy get better, both in our internal organizations and personally, then that enables us to do the work with our members better equipped to do that. And they're learning groups and communities within the forum. And we do we've surveyed to see where everybody is, and we will continue to support and watch their progress and their growth. And as well as that becomes core in terms of what our conference always looks like and how we are now taking that racial equity lens across all of our work. So it's not, right. I say it's a pillar because it's primary to us, but it's across the entire organization and all the work we do. So then the next big pillar, which has grown considerably since 2016, is our public policy work and our advocacy work. And we both have always done policy at the federal level in support of or protection or expansion of philanthropy. So a lot of things around taxes, tax benefits, regular, all those kind of stuff. But we have really evolved in that work and are centering our members as we have grown to all of these different members in the intersectionality of issues, but also what they mean and how they stand and respond to racial equity as well as social justice. And so that lens is now on everything that we do. One example of some of the work that we did at the federal level was we worked very hard with colleagues across the country to ensure that not-for-profits were included in the relief from the COVID packages, because in the first they were not.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how that lands and how this lands even in this next package with the Biden administration, that's talking more about getting additional monies to the ground and to small businesses and to the places where they were hard, things were hard to go get to. So that's a huge piece. We do events usually in Washington. This year we will be remote. It's called Foundations on the Hill, where we bring foundations from all over the country to talk to our legislators with one unified voice about the importance of the sector. You know, what is our role in society? What is our role in terms of advocacy and public policy? How can we be a resource and a partner to have better things done? And this has been a big piece of the work, because we have a fundamental belief that in philanthropy, if you are not also engaging in advocacy and public policy, you're at the wrong end of the pipe, right? You know, you're ending up doing remedial work instead of fixing what's creating the issues. So we believe that that's a really vital part of our work. And then the last pillar is really around philanthropic practice. How do we do philanthropy better? We do a lot of work with our members individually, and you know, I think that we do a lot of skill building. We do professional development for the PSOs because we live in this sort of meta space. You know, we're not the foundations. We don't do philanthropy. We try to make philanthropy better. So what are the skills we need to work with those foundations across the country to do that better? I think as well as being a leader and a voice in discussions about what should philanthropy doing. We just released today a statement in response to everything that's happened and all the things that are going on that really calls philanthropy to use everything they've got, you know, their voices, their relationships, and their money to support organizations that are doing the work of social justice and equity, and to not use charity to support hate or groups critical. That should not. Yeah. So that's, I'm part of a, working with a group, the Horizon initiative, that is really talking very specifically about that and figuring out how do we change practice so that donor advised funds or community foundations are paying attention to where dollars are going and using their variance power to ensure that the charitable dollars are supporting things for the common good. And I think that those are some of the really critical things that we're thinking about right now. So right. That was a lot, I know.
No, but I think
we're doing a lot.
For sure. And I think on that last piece about philanthropy not supporting hate, like that's kind of where we met in DC yeah. at the discussion that was hosted by CARE and Southern Poverty Law Center. Exactly. So I think it's super critical, especially as a community foundation that hosts donor advised funds, that we commit to ensuring that our families that we work with will not be contributing to hate-based organizations, and actually try to shift the narrative in the philanthropic community to show that philanthropy has power, philanthropy has privilege. And what we are doing to make sure that we define the narrative of how philanthropy can be used for good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I, you know, I think it is, we're at a very particular moment in terms of everything in this country. And I think philanthropy needs to sort of understand that their privilege, and their resources, much of it came on the backs of the origins of this country, which were not good, right? So right. This is a country that was founded through genocide and through slavery and many other things, and why I love and will do everything I can to meet the aspirations of what America wants to be. I think the first place that you need to do that is reckon with who you are. Not what you want to be. And I think we are in that moment. And philanthropy is as a core piece of who this country is, and a third leg of the stool, if you will, needs to reckon with a lot of that and figure out the best use of resources and what is equity? What does it look like?
All right. So I think this gives us a good opportunity to kind of shift into some of these challenges or trends that we are seeing in philanthropy, and kind of some advice for families who want to be more strategic with their charitable giving and how they can do that, or just kind of resources and best practices that you'd like to share.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we're lucky in this moment that there are lots of resources that are accessible. There's in terms of doing public policy work or advocacy, if you want to understand a little bit better about it, Alliance for Justice is a great place to go for resources that will tell you, yes, you can and should be doing this. Yes, it is a okay thing to do, and here are the rules of the road for that. So I think that's a particularly important one. I think BoardSource also, we have a partnership with them. And there are lots of materials on their site about the role of boards with foundations and not-for-profits. I think one of the things that I think needs to have some alignment, and it kind of goes back to sort of how is this hate philanthropy even happening, You know, many foundations spend a lot of time thinking about their mission and their vision and their values. But to make sure that you are really aligning that with your grant making and doing due diligence, you know, GuideStar is a good resource to really get deep, detailed information on grantees. I think that that's part of the challenge also with community foundations who hold donor advised funds, or, you know, they have their mission, vision, and values on the wall, but it may not be in their donor contracts, and it needs to be.
Very good point. Yeah.
Right. And I think for an individual, it's hard. I often describe, having been a funder, that feeling of like you're standing on a train, right, with the door open and trees are whizzing by you and you're trying to grab a tree. You just like, you need to figure out what's the thing you can do. And so I do believe that really finding something that is meaningful to you, because I think philanthropy, you know, means, you know, love of one's brother, other. I don't think you do that unless you have a full relationship, right? So I think you need to know the places where your money is going so that you also are filled by that, because love needs to be reciprocal to really grow and be healthy. And I think that that is the most rewarding way to do philanthropy. I personally, you know, I'm in a women's giving circle in Baltimore. And I wanted to do that because I wanted, one, to get to know more people since I've been out of Baltimore for 30 years, but also I wanted to be an instrument of change in that group. I, when I joined and looked at the members in Baltimore City, there were over 400 women in the organization and there were only 3 women of color. And so I said, I will join if there is a process by which we change that. We change the way the organization looks and feels so that others will feel welcome. And so we are now working on a 3-year project with that. So I like to not only just write checks, though I do that a lot, and I'll mention that in a minute, but now everybody's going to send me requests, I know, but it doesn't matter. I get them all anyhow. I've been doing this work for 30 years. Everybody knows where I am. But I also like to be involved. I like to figure out sort of, is there something more that I can do?
Of course.
You know, I am part of the Washington National Cathedral, their racial justice task force. And I have watched the power of also that place being used as a national gathering place to hear and listen to amazing people. We just did a thing with Dr. Fauci and the head of the National Health Organization, the hospital, talking about COVID over a period of time. Like, we had like an hour and a half conversation. So it was not sound bites. It was intellectual, rich discourse about something that impacted many people. So supporting that place as both my parish, but as a place that serves the nation, but that I'm also involved with. To me, that is a more meaningful thing. But I also, you know, I came back to Baltimore because Baltimore is struggling. And so trying to understand what one can do in one's own community on the ground, right? So it's interesting how I think about charitable giving, because I think about it in a really broad sense. So it's not just writing checks, but oftentimes it's, you know, keeping your neighborhood businesses in business by supporting them. It's you know, figuring out how to call somebody if you're on a call list that needs help. I also wrap my advocacy work deeply into it. So I was just very moved by a lot of the political campaigns that were happening. And though I don't get a tax credit for those, to me, it builds sort of the way I think about the world I'm in and things. probably the most powerful work that I have done, I think, in my career has been over the last 4 years in my role at United Philanthropy Forum, but also very personally working to ensure a fair and accurate census.
Definitely.
And I never really thought about that until you really understand that if someone is uncounted, one, you know, there is sort of an invisibility about that if you are not, you know, noted as being part of your community, but also the amount of resources that don't come down from the federal government to support communities that really need support. And the charitable dollars can't ever make up that gap that doesn't happen. So working to make that happen is in essence charitable work to me that was incredibly meaningful. And to protect people when the conversation came up about putting a citizenship question on the census, and we activated philanthropy to be signing on and sending comments to the Commerce Department. The first time we had over 300 foundations sign on to that. That's really meaningful. And it also, for me, you know, I am a philanthropist with a very small P or a very small wallet, however you want to say that. Mm-hmm. So I have to use everything else I've got to fortify what I do. And I think that is just a powerful way to amplify dollars and amplify kind of the way you want to change the world. And so I have on my wall the amicus brief that I edited that went to the Supreme Court. And that work was one of the more meaningful pieces of work I've ever done because it's where all those worlds come together. So I think you need to think about what is most meaningful to you. I do both close to home and far away. You know, I've had one of micro lending things since before anybody even knew what it was that just keeps regenerating the same, whatever it was. It was probably $100 20 years ago, and it's out in the world doing something. It keeps paying itself forward. So there's that, but then there's also, I look very close to home. You know, I also, this is really funny because, and I know I'm talking to people that have accounts in community foundations, but I like for them to think more broadly about it. I think tipping generously is one of the best forms
totally.
Of philanthropy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you're talking about service industries, and these are the people that, you know, are going to have to line up at food kitchens and pantries and things. And so thinking about how do you spread small and large and medium things. And how do you, so there's that. So that's more charitable, right? So philanthropy in being more strategic, I do think it is about being focused. I do think you need to pick a tree in some cases because your job is to be as educated as you can with where your money goes or to find somebody that is. I like also the idea of pooled funds where there is a philanthropy doing something and that you contribute to it. Because if you don't have the wherewithal or the resources or the time to be researching what's the best thing, if you really care about children's hunger, somebody's out there doing that and you can provide resources to that. That was one of the great things about the census work was we had a national pooled fund. Because people were like, what are you funding the census? Like, how do you figure that one out, right? So there was so much work happening to support, you know, the attorneys. there was data security. There was all kinds of sort of high-level stuff. But the important thing, too, is out of that pooled fund, they had a group of people that were able to be on the ground and seeing what grassroots groups were working in communities. So that pooled fund got that money down to the ground because they had the relationships and the resources and the wherewithal to understand who was really doing the work and who needed the money. I can't do that on my own. And so finding trusted partners. And there is, I'm drawing a complete blank because there's a great platform also. The Forum partnered with the Gates Foundation to get resources out during COVID through the Momentum Fund and pushed $8.5 billion out the door pretty quickly. Like start to finish.
That's remarkable.
Like, 3 months. And part of it was because we were a network of networks that knew what was happening on the ground. And we brought the expertise of our network around the table so that they can ensure that communities that were serving at-risk populations that had set up COVID funds, these grants were actually to build the capacity of those organizations. Because we knew that people sprung up to respond, especially in Black and Brown communities where they were being really devastated, but that wasn't what they were do normally. And so how do you sustain that? And so that's what these grants were about, because we also know that those communities who are the poorest, who were hit the hardest, will have the longest road to recovery. And so standing up the ability for those organizations to stay in that work longer was really critical. And so, but the ones that didn't get funded are now on a platform. And I really wish I could come up, the name just went totally out of my head. But we will put it, I will get it to you if there's a way that you can share it with folks. But
yeah, of course.
Because they've all been vetted, right? So this is the secret of all that stuff, right? So if all those grantees have been vetted as being great, there just wasn't, believe it or not, an $8.5 million enough money. So they're on a platform that a funder can go in and research. And that's also, you know, in foundations, community foundations in particular, you know the community. You have experience with lots of ways to hold funders together to learn and to understand if they have common issues, you know, who's out there doing good work and who's not. You know, I think that there are many ways, and I think it is really the responsibility of the funders, the philanthropists, to really do that work and understand it. And if they don't have the time to commit to a community foundation or another organization that has that detail on it.
A lot of what you said definitely resonates. And I think, you know, when it comes to philanthropy, it's about utilizing your time, talent, and treasure, right? So whether, you know, you don't have that much to give financially, you can still give with your time, you can still give with your skill set and have as much impact. And, you know, I really like that, you know, when you returned back to Baltimore, you engaged in a giving circle. And AMCF has giving circles that we operate. We're trying to launch a national American Muslim Women's Giving Circle. We're also launching Interfaith Giving Circle Confronting Hate. Again, a national network of people who identify with their faith and want to make a difference to stand up against hate and bigotry. We also did work around mobilizing the Muslim community to participate in the census, as it's very critical to make sure that there's representation there so that more funding comes to local communities across the country where you know, Muslims are. And although we may be only 1% of the general population, I think it's still significant to make sure that we are active in our local communities at the state level and federal level as well. And we're definitely seeing more of that. And I think that, you know, all the stuff that you've been doing around advocacy is super critical as well, because there's such integration between democracy, social justice, philanthropy, and the gap that exists from government services and ways in which philanthropy can make a difference and try to shorten that gap, you know? We definitely covered a lot of ground. Is there anything else about United Philanthropy Forum that you'd like to share?
So I think that I think it's always interesting for people to understand and recognize that there is an infrastructure and so many resources to support them in their journey around philanthropy. And we like to be sort of that thing. We're a little bit meta, but our members are sort of more out there and on the ground and have incredible information. But I was just thinking when you were talking about your giving circles, David Brooks had a column in the New York Times, I think on the 31st of December, And he was talking about, it was really talking about how so many diversity programs and things don't work. And that the way in which we come together and as a country and as a people in a way of building relationships is how we will learn to live in peace and love and really understand the meaning of philanthropy in a more significant way. So being in community when you are talking about your philanthropy, I think is really critical, even if you feel like the act of philanthropy is very private, which a lot of people do. The being in community to learn and to think about it and to pull together, I think, is the most beautiful expression of philanthropy. So I'm a huge advocate of giving circles and the types that you are actually doing, I think, or the interfaith one in particular is truly in the spirit of philanthropy.
Well, thank you for that. So let's take the last few minutes to just kind of talk about personal nonprofits that you support and why they are meaningful to you.
So obviously the Baltimore Women's Giving Circle is one. And the cathedral, for me, my philanthropy, like so many others, is very much tied to my faith. I am an Episcopalian, and I was born Irish Catholic. So as my mother would say, I'm a Catholic light now. But I think I'm a Catholic deep now, because all of the things that I do and the way in which I hope to be, inform my philanthropy. So I very much support the Maryland Food Bank. I support museums occasionally because that has been such a gift of my life to be in beautiful spaces. I support I actually support two churches, my one in Baltimore and my one in DC, not because I'm supporting actually the church, I'm supporting their social justice work, right? So the church in the cathedral here in Baltimore is doing a lot of work with refugees and immigrants. And so supporting their clothing drives and their financial drives and things like that are meaningful to me because everything I do, I think I'm trying to learn from and get better at being, being the person I want to see walking through the world, doing things that are generous and empathetic and that make me stronger in my walk. So I think those are, I'm pretty responsive. I actually had to take during this last year, I took to send money to things too often. So I'm very emotionally responsive, which is not a good strategy. But I think you need to just think about what makes you a stronger and better human being through the philanthropy that you're doing. What do you really have a passion for in making a difference that you can say at the end of the day, when you put your head down to rest, that you have given of yourself in a significant way? And that's sort of how I think about it.
Yeah, I think that is spot on. And you know, everybody's personal journey with philanthropy and their journey with money is different for each and every person. But I think everybody wants to make a difference with it as well. And oftentimes those with the least of it are sometimes the most generous.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really grateful for your time and sharing with American Muslim Community Foundation your experience at the United Philanthropy Forum and just kind of these trends that we're seeing in philanthropy and what each of us can do to, use our agency to promote change. And I think that's a really big part of why AMCF was founded. We want to make sure that Muslim philanthropy has a voice, that it has a place in mainstream philanthropy, and that is just part of the conversation. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. I was so grateful to have met you and grateful to continue our relationship. Thank you for the work you do.
Likewise.